Gentlemen, having heard from the stage one version of what goes on in the Democratic Party, I know you'll want to hear from a distinguished member of that group. I present to you Senator Eugene J. McCarthy of Minnesota.
Chairman Riggs, and Mr. President, my colleague from the Republican side, Mr. Martin, distinguished members of the Gridiron Club, and distinguished guests. As I was about to get up to speak, the Secretary of the Interior, Mr. Udall, said, "Why did they pick you?" Well, he and I served in the House of Representatives together, and having served in that body, one carries no respect as he goes on to the Senate. I'd given some thought to this question myself and concluded that the one group that really hasn't fully accepted this administration yet are the liberals. And I've been designated a spokesman for the liberals. This is a designation you get without really seeking it. I thought once or twice of resigning from the ADA, but it sounds so bad to say I was a former member. My defense now is to say I'm a member for the FBI. This carries me a long way. Well, the liberals are hard to please. They like to think of themselves as something like the Hungarian government in exile. They're uneasy when they're in the majority. And I say this may be a part of the problem. There may be a better reason, however. I like to believe that the head of the Democratic Party may have concurred in my choice, that is the president. He and I have much in common. Both of us nominated Adlai Stevenson for president. He in 56 and I in 60. Some difference in our timing, but you run these together. Matter of fact, we had a lot in common even at the 1960 convention. We had the same set of candidates for both offices. We just didn't sort them out quite the same way. I had only one candidate for vice president. In that field, I had no religious prejudices. I had almost every other candidate for the presidency. The president had only one candidate for the presidency. He had many candidates for the vice presidency. And on them, he did draw a rather hard religious line. Well, I ran for the Senate in 1958, and there were some astute newspaper men who said I was kind of a precursor, that I was John the Baptist, making straight the way. Said in Minnesota that I, as a Catholic, won over a Lutheran. And I might add, I had troubles with the clergy before the election. And this is when it's real trouble. Two weeks before my election, the Archbishop decided to denounce Martin Luther. When I protested, I said he'd been around, or at least his reputation, for 400 years, and I thought they could let it live for two more weeks. Not only that, but he organized a rosary crusade. Instead of having it end up at the cathedral, he insisted that they finish up on the Capitol grounds. Like having a pilgrimage from Boston, led by the Cardinal, winding up on the Capitol Mall 2 weeks before election. This was my problem in Minnesota. Well, I overcame that handicap, they said. I was younger than my opponent. I was said to be less experienced. My background was an urban background, and in the realm of politics, they called me an intellectual. I found that a little learning goes a long way in that field. But in any case, after this was all over, a number of astute newspaper men wrote articles saying that I had proved that one with all these handicaps could win. I was quite set up until I overheard someone say, "Well, it might just prove that, but it might have proved that anybody could win." Well, I think that once we're elected, we shouldn't look too closely at the votes we get, or the reasons as to why people do vote for us. I'm sure that Candidate Kennedy had a hard time deciding between Governor Freeman and I when he looked about for a nominator because, well, both of us had had experience. We had both nominated Hubert Humphrey in the past. This is a severe test. We hadn't been really successful, but at least there was enough on the record for him to look. And I might add that Adley has told me that he doesn't feel too badly. He lost a nomination. He lost a law firm. But he gained a great deal in the administration. I want to say a word to the press before I proceed to talk about Democrats and Republicans. I don't want to say I have sympathy for them. I have admiration for them. The press has never bothered me very much, either for good or bad. This is a problem for House members and for young senators, I might note. But in the course of the Eisenhower administration, I thought that, well, they really proved themselves. In the days of Harry Truman, reporting, political reporting, that is, was relatively simple. He was a Democrat and took a pretty clear stand and let you know where he stood. If you had to get into religion, it was relatively simple. Once in a while, the Baptist would want to throw him out and he'd refuse to go. You might have to write about a swear word once in a while as he played poker or took a drink, but the religious reporting was quite simple in that administration. And the medical reporting was quite simple, too. Once in a while, a case of indigestion, but that was about the limit of it. But with the Eisenhower administration, things became very complicated. There was a kind of forced signal of this. In the campaign, the candidate and most of his supporters said that their approach to politics would be different. They said that it would be non-political and it would be moral and spiritual. Well, this should have served as a warning. After they were elected, of course, the problem did exist. It was hard to sort out the politics from the religion. It was even hard to sort out the religion. I think that Bill Miller, who wrote a little piece called Piety Along the Potomac in those days, had it about right. This was not the president's personal piety, but the rather generally pious air that prevailed throughout the administration. He said, well, it was somewhat like their politics. He said it was a very vague religion, very strongly held to. Well, you can't say that about the administration of this religion. Quite specific. A lot of canon law. A lot of complications. And this has put a new burden on the press. I might note that for years the great religious controversy was over private interpretation of the Bible. But now it's moved over to private interpretation of the Constitution. This opens up a whole new field. And I think I ought to warn the members of the Supreme Court who are here that they'd better begin to guard the chicken house because this gets too far. We know what happened to organized religion along about the 15th or 16th century. There's some dangers to organized law. And we'd better put a stop to, or at least slow down, this particular movement. But it's in the field of medicine, I think, that the new challenge really exists. The press had done pretty well along towards the end of the Eisenhower administration. They had pretty good knowledge of all of the illnesses of the, well, the male who had passed his peak, the geriatrics in general. And then along came a new campaign and a new administration, and they've had to move on now to, well, obstetrics to begin with. This is just a beginning now. We're into pediatrics, and this can go on, I'd say, almost without limit. But the press has responded very well. They responded to the challenge of the Eisenhower administration, and I think they've responded very effectively to the challenges of the last campaign and the challenges of this administration. I think, as most Democrats, for some reasons, hate to see this administration go. They were a moving target. Just barely. But in any case, it was a target, and Democrats generally are rather sporting fellows. But when we get near a sick bed or around an undertaking establishment, why, we become very kind. I don't mean to say that the Republicans have quite reached this state. They have the gift of survival. Even at their high points of life, they're not very vigorous, but in the period of decline, they're like the lower forms of plant and animal life. It's really hard to destroy them. They have a gift, kind of a gift of survival, and this is the state in which we find them now. They're somewhat dormant. They're hibernating, but there is life in them. I want to assure all Democrats that we've got to keep on guard. I miss them for another reason. It's kind of like losing the last section of a cereal. Back in 1953, soon after the successful election, the Republican chairman was Leonard Hall, and he announced in quite a formal way that they were going to remake the Republican Party in the image of President Eisenhower. Seemed like an interesting undertaking, a kind of reincarnation, a kind of mystical political body we were to expect. Well, this went on for a while, and nothing seemed to happen. And then the word came out that a man named Arthur Larson had written a book called A Republican Looks at His Party. And the next word was that the president had read it. this was later denied. I think it was Ed Folliard who scooped everybody on that and said flatly it had not been read. But in any case, this was accepted as the word on Republicans. And generally, they found that they already were what they thought they had to make themselves. And this simplified it a great deal. And this was a kind of a high point. They had wonderful phrases. They spoke of progressive moderation. This was supposed to answer all questions. This is a gradual slowdown. We didn't know what it meant, but this was what was going on. And then they got really enthusiastic, and they said that they were standing, as I recall it, firmly astride the authentic American center, grasping the American consensus. I don't think that would get by the censors if you looked at it too closely. But this was the declaration, and there were to be no more questions after this point. Well, they were shocked in 58 in the congressional elections and decided that they needed another re-examination. They had two going at that time. They had a special commission to determine goals for America. Some of us thought it was a little late in the administration to set up that commission. And they had, along with that, a committee to determine what the Republican Party stood for. Well, that committee reported shortly before the election, and the chairman, Mr. Percy, said that he would summarize it in these two words, dynamic conservatism. And that's where they left it, as they went into the campaign with a really almost impossible proposition for the Republican candidate. He had really three levels, or three layers of Republicanism with which he had to deal, or three camps. There was the most advanced group that said there are problems and something should be done about them, but not at this time. This kept them honest. This kept them in the camp. There was another group that said there are problems, and they were considered a little bit forward-looking, but they didn't go beyond that. There was a third group that said there are problems and we ought to do less about them than we're doing now. Well, all three of these people had a home in that campaign. And then Rockefeller came along and he spoiled everything. He said there are problems and we ought to do something about them now. And when he said now, things began to come apart. The Republican candidate was doing very well. He had one foot in each of three camps, but when they called upon him to put one in the fourth, this was too much for him. And he was like the proverbial chameleon who got along well until he tried to cross the Scotch plaid. And at that point, as the poet says, true to his chameleon instincts, he died in the switches. Well, this is what they took into the campaign, and I say success for the Democrats with a candidate and with the program was almost inevitable. I would say that the most significant point of contrast between the last administration and what we've seen of this one, and it may be a little bit early to pass any very final judgment on it, I would go so far as to say this, that, it's the line that a critic used in talking about Liberace. Said he didn't know whether they played well, but he was sure he played fast. And we can say this of the administration up to this point. But the great point of contrast, I think, has been that of the manner in which people have accepted appointments in this administration, in contrast with the manner in which they accepted appointments in the last. The men called to the new frontier, well, it's almost like something out of Exodus. You get the impression that they're standing with their shoes tied and their loins girt and their staff in hand. And when the call comes, why, they leave. In the last administration, you may recall, there was hesitation. There were apologies. There was reluctance. Well, I remember when Ezra Benson was asked to come. Well, we were in a state of indecision for about 2 weeks. He finally, he made this statement in Utah. He said he'd received a witness from the Almighty that he was to go, and with that recommendation, he came. But in the case of Governor Freeman, why, he was almost like Cincinnati. He just dropped the plow right in the furrow. Of course, they say that the real classical scholars say that Cincinnatus was never found plowing any place excepting on the front 40 when the call came. But in any case, he didn't unhitch. He just dropped it, and away he came. When Mr. McKay came in as the Secretary of Interior, he left his Chevrolet dealership with reluctance. But Secretary Udall just beached the canoe and dropped his paddle, and on he came. Perhaps the most striking contrast was that in the office of the Secretary of Defense. Most of you remember, and here we had a fair basis for comparison because both men were coming from the automobile industry, similar background. Mr. Wilson came reluctantly. You may remember his explanation as to what he put first, General Motors and then the country. Mr. McNamara didn't say that. They both had some similar troubles. Mr. Wilson didn't know that space existed, and Mr. McNamara, well, they had to have some of those philosophers from Harvard take him aside and give him a lesson in relativity. And after he got the note on relativity, why, he understood something more of politics and missile gaps and some of the other problems of space. But in any case, he came quite eagerly. He came without any particular apologies to Ford or any protestations as to what he was giving up. I might note for Mr. McNamara, if he still communicates with Ford, if there's no conflict of interest, I hope that the President will excuse him in this instance if there is, because this is an old failing. The problem of the Edsel. Mr. Goldwater, Senator Goldwater, has been talking about the forgotten man. Now, if the forgotten man, he defines as the fellow who's on the way up but isn't sure he's going to make it, or the man who's on the way down but doesn't want people to know it, or the fellow who's kind of given up. And it seems to me that this is just about what Ford Motor had in mind for the Edsel. This could kind of be the Volkswagen for the forgotten man in the Goldwater administration. And I do hope that if you've got those old plans left lying around, Mr. McNamara, that you tell Ford to hold on to them, at least until after 1968. The difference not only in the manner of coming, but well, kind of the atmosphere. In the Eisenhower administration, there was something known as the call. Nobody knew who called, but the call came. The only man who wasn't called was George Humphrey. You got the impression that the President, after being inaugurated, went out on the White House lawn, and there was George under the oak tree. He said, "Before you were, I am." But from that time on, there was word of the call. Everybody was being called in and called back, and they came quietly, or at least they left quietly. Roger Keyes was called in and then called back. Secretary of the Treasury was called in for one purpose, and then we were told called back, and then he was recalled. And this went on for some time. Neil McElroy, a kind of call. I think his song was, "I Hear My Pension Calling," when he finally departed. But this was more or less the way it went. And then there were the departures. For the most part, quiet and willing departures. There were one or two who went with joy. I think that Jim Mitchell is one of these. You know, the word we had was that during the last year of his service, that before going to work, he used to have his wife pull the rug out from under him two or three times. He'd take two falls forward and two back, and then he was ready to go to the White House. Well, he left willingly, as did most. There's one exception, however, I understand, that's the case of Mr. Summerfield. He came reluctantly and threatened to quit once or twice, but this was before he discovered the wonderful world of books. And after that, why, they say he's hesitant about leaving. He's not decided. He thinks there are, well, really two ways open to him. One, to be a librarian, and the other, to be a gamekeeper. And he hasn't quite decided as to which of these vocations or occupations he ought to take. I suppose this is really the significant contrast. You have a postmaster general retiring who wouldn't even let them send through the mail a book written by another postmaster general. Well, really what is involved in this new administration is a kind of change of spirit. I would say that it's a return of the spirit that possessed this country, I would say, in 1776 and in 1789. It was a new spirit which was described in those days in this term of public happiness, a sense of the need to participate in public office, to participate in the activities and in the direction of government. The men of the Revolution were not opposed to taxation. They were opposed to taxation without representation. They were not opposed to centralized government, but they were opposed to a government in which they had no part. They were not opposed to having troops quartered with them if the troops who were quartered were their own troops. And this idea of public happiness was best described by John Quincy Adams, who said that the men of colonial America went to town meetings and participated in assemblies because they delighted in the dialogue, because they delighted in discussions, not because they had any special interests which they wished to advance, but because they were concerned with advancing the public good. And I say this is the significant characteristic of this administration, that it brings to government in this United States a spirit of public happiness. And I'm sure that all of you share with me in saying that we do hope that this spirit of public happiness, which infects this administration, becomes a genuine cause of public happiness throughout this land.